It is my privilege and honor to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. Jean Dunham. It isn't very often you get to say you've known someone both in as a friend and as a professional colleague for all 45 years plus. And when I tell you a little bit about Jean's background, I think you'll find that she is a unique individual, both in our state and nationally, in the way that she has pursued with a laser focus an emphasis on information literacy. She started as my first librarian when I was a teacher at Lincoln School. So she came in to train our staff in how to help students learn the truth, how to find the things they were interested in, how to verify whether they were real, that kind of thing. Well, of course, she was so skilled, she became the coordinator of Iowa City's library program and technology for many years. And that was exactly why Iowa City Schools had a fabulous selection policy that really dealt with banned books from the 1970s on. Pretty impressive. That ours has been a model for many, many, many places because of Jean's leadership there. Across the state, she has influenced so many students and faculty members at colleges with her emphasis on critical thinking and why information is important to know, and that pursuit that really is, I think, the issue of our time and has been really for the last 30 years. How do you know something is true? Where do you get your news? How do you vet your sources so you really are not spewing misinformation to people? And how do you frame it so you can think for yourself about what is really going on around you locally and statewide and nationally? Well, Jean taught at the University of Northern Iowa and the University of Iowa, both as in library science and information skills. So all of those students. She was the head of Cornell College Library. And by the way, that college has a college library and a public library in one building. So she oversaw all that. And then, of course, she's been active in many organizations. And if you look her up, you will find many, many publications, books, articles. She is revered as a very special person across all, everywhere on information skills. So I feel very happy that she was willing to come speak for us tonight. Some of you may have taken one of her senior college classes on fake news, and she has tweaked that and updated with things that have gone on now in the last 2 years. Tonight we're going to hear conspiracies, hoaxes, and rumors, discerning facts in a 24/7 news cycle. She will take questions after she's finished. This is a lot of content, so feel free to get up and get another glass of water or a cookie or something and really relax so you can hear a thought-provoking conversation about what's going on in our world today. And then afterwards, she'll answer questions. So please join me in welcoming Jean, and thank you very much.
Well, that's intimidating. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. I look forward to sharing the things that I've discovered about this topic over the last several years of investigation as it's become a bigger and bigger part of our lives, I would say. I've spent several years engaged with the professional and scholarly literature about the topic of fake news. And over time, I've come to find that term inadequate and ill-defined. So today, I'm choosing to use more precise language as we talk about the issues in our information landscape. I'm going to focus on disinformation, which differs from misinformation or satire, and is, frankly, to my way of thinking, the most dangerous form of false news. Disinformation is intentionally disseminated to mislead. It's fabricated information that mimics news content in form, but lacks the authentic news media's editorial norms and the processes for ensuring accuracy and credibility. The aim is often politically motivated, to attack government, to malign individuals, or to promote political beliefs. Whether it is a conspiracy theory, a hoax, a rumor, or simply a lie, disinformation is dangerous to a functional democratic society. Discussion of conspiracy theories, lies, and hoaxes can scarcely avoid appearing to exhibit some degree of partisanship. A peer-reviewed study in the American Journal of Political Science found that persons who are familiar with politics but have little trust in institutions are more susceptible to disinformation. And so there is a population that falls prey more readily than other parts of our population. All that said, my intent here is to explicate what constitutes disinformation, why it is accepted, and to explore potential directions we might consider personally and collectively to address this ongoing problem. My intent is not to promote further existing political divide, but rather to help us understand how disinformation contributes to it. Today, we will explore the nature of disinformation. We'll examine the role of social media in dissemination of disinformation. And we will consider a few authoritative and balanced sources we might go to for our news. And so let us proceed. Let me tell you, it was not Sarah Palin speaking of lies. Let's begin with a definition of a conspiracy theory to start us off. So a conspiracy theory is a belief that some covert but influential organization is responsible for a circumstance or an event. Conspiracy theories have one of several attributes. They can be contradictory. For example, the same people can believe that COVID is a hoax and simultaneously believe that the Chinese exported COVID intentionally. They are characterized often by overriding suspicion. For example, suspecting that medical professionals are being pressured to count patients as COVID patients, even if they don't know whether those patients have tested negative or positive, because the government wants higher numbers to show the devastation of the virus. So, suspicion. They often grow out of nefarious intent. Some people, for example, believe that NASA alters weather data to promote the idea of climate change. Their intent is to diminish the importance of climate change and its effects in order to support other interests. They often carry a message that something must be wrong, a certain sort of suspicion. Often, people who are taken in by disinformation pride themselves in being skeptical. So, when Antonin Scalia died, during the Obama administration, we heard flying around the internet, there's something fishy in Texas. Often people in this who are taken in this way portray themselves as persecuted victims and at the same time brave antagonists. For example, the Democrats have invented the Corona hoax so they can eliminate wealthy older voters and win more elections. The ideas found in these in this range in this field of disinformation are often immune to evidence. I mentioned that people often take pride in skepticism. However, there's something wrong with skepticism when we remain skeptical even in the face of overwhelming evidence. Witness the adherence to the claim that the election was stolen in face of mounting evidence to the contrary. The document Lost, Not Stolen, recently released, provides data from trials in Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, where there were claims of fraud. Yet this document provides evidence proving otherwise. Sadly, I have seen this document referenced rather little in even the mainstream media or in any media, and yet it lays out the evidence in those cases that support the notion that the election was not, in fact, stolen. Finally, believers have a tendency to reinterpret randomness. A technical term for this is illusory pattern perception. Take that one home with you. The increasing number of people on 5G cellular networks led to a spike in the number of COVID infections. Well, concurrent events, but not causation. Recognizing these attributes can help us identify and counter this particular form of disinformation. We see several of these attributes in the Stop the Steal theory, perhaps the most dangerous example in our current information universe. Disinformation threatens our health and safety. It threatens our way of governance. It threatens specific population subgroups. It even can threaten individuals. So how serious a problem is this? Well, let's consider a few examples and look at the seriousness of their impact. COVID has prompted various rumors, lies, and even conspiracy theories. A recent study by the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security estimated that false or misleading information about COVID has continued to inflict between $50 and $300 million in total harm to our nation alone every day since May of 2021, when vaccinations to prevent COVID became available. Think about that economic impact. It has hindered the practice of healthy behaviors, hand washing, social distancing, vaccinations, and promoted erroneous practices like taking ivermectin. COVID disbelievers believe that the number of deaths related to the coronavirus has been exaggerated. This idea has been endorsed by 30% of Americans. Nearly 20% of Americans believe that the pandemic is a ruse to install tracking devices inside our bodies. You know, Bill Gates is up to that. Some 25% believe that COVID was bioengineered in China with intention to do harm. Clearly, the conspiracy theories around COVID have had impact on our economies around the world, on Asians and Asian Americans who have been treated badly, on individuals' health and well-being affected by refusals to accept public health recommendations, including vaccines. So this bucket of conspiracy theories and disinformation has mattered. Let's look at another conspiracy theory that has to do with fraudulent elections. It too has had devastating impact. It's interesting to consider the case of Mr. Ayers, who testified in the January 6th committee hearing, where he acknowledged that he had been influenced by disinformation that led him to believe the proposition that the election had been stolen. He is no doubt not the only January 6th participant to have been so misled. Indeed, a research group from Harvard's Kennedy School Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy studied defendants indicted for the January 6th event and found that believing that the election was stolen motivated at least 40% of those people. Disinformation that led to deaths and serious injuries and a near-miss destruction of an important democratic process, the peaceful transition of power. Why would people like Stephen Ayers be taken in by this line of disinformation? Well, interestingly, in the early 1960s, American social psychologist Stanley Milgram set about to understand why German enablers of Adolf Hitler were compliant to orders from figures of authority. In his experiments, 65% of participants were willing to inflict harm in the experiment. It was a presumed electrical shock on a person if they were told to do so. Many of the January 6th participants, including Mr. Ayers, fall into what Milgram called an agentic state, in which a person allows another individual to take responsibility for and dictate the direction of their actions. They rationalize and attempt to validate the actions of their authority figure. Obedience to authority is so deeply ingrained that the authority figure could tell people to do something they would never do otherwise, and they do it. When the instruction is received from a respected authority figure, whom the individual has deemed to be legally and morally authorized, it leads to obedience. Reflecting on the experiment, Milgram said, "Ordinary people simply doing their jobs without any particular hostility on their part can become agents in a destructive process. Such agents, it seems, may be among those who went to Washington." Interestingly, when Milgram modified his experiment slightly, he obtained different results. When participants were tested in groups instead of individually, overall compliance rates dropped precipitously. The behavior of the participants' peers strongly affected their behavior. This finding suggests that maybe social pressure from a respected source from within may affect willingness to go along. Another example is the disinformation talk about President Biden. Whether it is rumors of his purported senility or about his purported end to oil drilling on federal land. When President Trump was in office, we heard talk of a deep state among conspiracy theories. Recently, the message has been that the deep state has collapsed and that Biden is on his way to becoming a dictator and is ready to impose martial law. Believers point to his use of executive orders, counterterrorism training in the military, Dr. Fauci infringing on people's freedom. Now, these ideas would sound like fantasy, except that they have a following. Such talk feeds the destructive divisiveness in our country and contributes to lack of trust and, frankly, to government's inability to function. Replacement theory is yet another conspiracy theory with consequences. Those who believe in replacement theory think there is an organized effort across all levels of society to establish a great replacement of white people, white civilization, and white culture. Now, 4 out of 10 Americans identify as non-white, and the number of white people in the United States is expected to continue to decline, according to census projections. That ultimately means less influence and power over time for white people. Replacement theory believers think that they must correct the declining influence of white voters and white identity through whatever means they can. A May 2022 Associated Press poll found that about 1 in 3 adults in the United States, quote, believes an effort is underway to replace U.S.-born Americans with immigrants for electoral gains. Replacement theory was also central to a white supremacist Unite the Right rally in August 2017 when hundreds of white nationalists protested in Charlottesville, Virginia. They marched and chanted, You will not replace us. Jews will not replace us. Buffalo, New York shooter wrote in his pre-Carnage treatise, quote, all black people are replacers just by existing in white countries. The white race is dying out, and hence his behavior. Even Tucker Carlson and Laurel Ingraham have both claimed, quote, the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate with new people, more obedient voters from the third world, unquote. Proliferation of and belief in conspiracy theories have consequences. Social media plays a big role in proliferation. Sadly, once a news item is out there, it has powerful staying and spreading capacity. Jonathan Swift got it right in 1710 when he stated, falsehood flies and the truth comes limping after it, so that when men come to be undeceived, it is too late. The jest is over and the tale hath had its effect. This is far more true today, where what goes onto the internet tends not to go away, than it might have been in 1710. So why do people believe? How do people fall prey to disinformation? As we consider factors that cause people to be taken in, think about Stephen Ayers from the January 6th hearings. You'll recall that he described himself as a working man, a family man. During his testimony, Mr. Ayers recounted how he was swept up in the false claims of voter fraud and believed the election was stolen, in part because he followed the former president on several social media accounts. Ayers described himself as an American family man, worked at a cabinet factory, enjoyed playing basketball and camping with his family. He attended the Stop the Steal rally, but said he had no intention of going to or entering the Capitol until the president instructed his followers to march to the building. Basically, the president, quote, basically, the president got everyone riled up, told everyone to head on down, so we were following what he said, Mr. Ayers said. He said that when Mr. Trump finally asked the rioters to leave, he did so. He believes that if the president had asked the rioters to leave the Capitol earlier, they probably would have left. Since then, Mr. Ayers testified, he stopped believing that the election was stolen. In addition to the criminal charges he faced, he lost his job. He had to sell his home. He testified that following the call on January 6th changed his life, but not for the good. I was hanging on every word he was saying, everything he was putting out, I was following it. I mean, if I was doing it, hundreds of thousands of millions of people were doing it, or maybe are even still doing it today, Mr. Ayers said. So why do people believe? Well, one of the factors may be the complexity of the issues we face today. We live in a complex world. Think about how complicated our systems are, how complex our technologies are. The global financial system, how many of us can say we really understand it? Multiculturalism is complicated for many people. Data storage in the cloud, do we really get it? A desire to make sense of our world makes us susceptible to simpler answers. And after all, it is part of the human condition to always be trying to make sense of our world. Many people have little tolerance for uncertainty. Consequently, we seek an explanation, any explanation, regardless of how likely it might be. Fear is another factor that contributes to our susceptibility. Studies show that conspiracy theories tend to snowball during times of crisis when fear is rampant and clear explanations are in short supply. They appeal in part because they offer a straightforward narrative and oftentimes give us someone to blame. To say that the whole world has come to a halt because a teeny-weeny virus jumped from a bat to another animal and then to a guy in a Chinese market seems far too insignificant an explanation for the pandemic we have been living with for many of us. But a theory that has thousands of people in cahoots, that seems more proportional. Of course, there is the problem of echo chambers. We all live in our own echo chambers, don't we? Once an idea is endorsed, confirmation bias kicks in, leading us to seek out and perceive consistent information, information that reaffirms what we've now come to believe, thus solidifying our belief and making us increasingly resistant to any other ideas. Simplistic theories are also more appealing than the truth sometimes because it's too complicated, and simpler theories offer the possibility of feeling as if we can control it. And we are all control freaks at heart. I mentioned earlier this notion of illusory pattern perceptions, seeing patterns that may not be there, connecting the dots, trying to make meaning out of what we see. That's what we do as humans. This is often a situation of seeing a correlation and assigning causality. An interesting case in point, multiple Facebook users posted a video from Cobb County, Georgia, showing a person moving garbage cans to and from a truck with a label on the side of it, A1 Shredding and Recycling. The video appears to have been taken at an event center in Marietta, the Cobb County seat. The conclusion drawn by those observers, ballots were being destroyed. However, in fact, the shredding company routinely disposes of non-relevant materials after elections. The Cobb County Board of Elections and Registration provided a list of the items the shredding company helped dispose of, and the list did not include ballots. Still, the notion persisted. Another illusion is the illusory truth effect. If we hear something over and over enough times, it becomes more likely to be misidentified as the truth. That was the case of the Buffalo, New York shooter who followed a neo-Nazi forum on 4chan that repeatedly told him that the white race is dying out, repeated enough that it became his truth. When we hear things again and again, we take them for the truth. I'm guessing there's some number of people in this room who think that Sarah Palin said she could see Russia from her porch. She did not. Powerlessness and hopelessness can oftentimes be another factor that contributes to people's belief in disinformation. In an interview on NPR, journalist Amanda Ripley described studies that speak to the importance of hopefulness. She described it as a biological need and indicated that hopelessness correlates with conditions like depression, chronic pain, and sleeplessness. She further asserted that 40% of Americans avoid the news these days in order to avoid feeling hopeless. Now, I would submit this avoidance of news is dangerous to the notion of an informed public and sets people up to be vulnerable to a political rumor mill. Finally, trust and distrust. Most believers of disinformation aren't theorizing so much as they're looking for answers and finding ones that resonate with the mistrust that got them searching for it in the first place. People with a conspiracy mindset distrust nearly everyone, but most especially experts. So these are some of the explanations that the literature suggests about why people can be taken in by disinformation. Lest you think that this is a small minority of people who are taken in this way, let me share some data from a University of Chicago study. In this study, one of the consistent predictors of beliefs in disinformation is something that you might almost call an all-American attitude, a belief in individualism accompanied by a certain distrust of authority. Think of how many do not tread me on me signs and flags we see of people being concerned about government taking away their rights and their freedoms. So in this study, they found that at least 50% of Americans believe in at least one disproven conspiracy theory. Search your conscience. In addition, over 29% of Americans believe there was a deep state working in the government against President Donald Trump when he was in office. 27% of Americans believe that the FDA is withholding a natural cure for cancer. 25% of Americans believe that Wall Street bankers conspired to cause the 2008 financial crisis. And indeed, 11%, they found, of Americans believe the government is mandating compact fluorescent light bulbs to make us more obedient and easier to control. So it is more widespread than we might think. We think of disinformation as sitting at the fringe, but it's really moved to the mainstream. Witness the fact that Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA delivered the opening speech at the 2020 Republican National Convention. That's pretty mainstream. Algorithms in social media platforms help create echo chambers. Recall that illusory truth effect. If we keep hearing the same things over and over, pretty soon we believe that it's true. The appeal of the sensational is another problem for us all. Sensationalism is in the news, and we see it on most of the television news across the spectrum, is analogous to junk food. People kind of have an addiction to seeing the breaking news and the ways in which news media across all political, across, as I say, across the political spectrum, tend to sensationalize what's going on. So people have an addiction to this sensationalism, it seems, and it's a little like junk food. And like junk food, disinformation captures the public debate, and it drowns out more important and more significant news stories. Social trust also plays a role in proliferation in social media. My friend posted this, and I trust my friend, so must be good, so I'll just pass it along without any critical analysis before I do so. So that notion of social trust contributes also to the proliferation across social media. There are so many outlets inside each of our echo chambers. The French news outlet Le Monde has a database of more than 600 news sites that have been identified and tagged as either satire or fake. Think about that, 600 news outlets, and those are the ones they have in their database. Here we have, for example, One America News. It is known for promotion of conspiracy theories, has been an adamant supporter of the notion of the fraudulent election of 2020, and tends, of course, to be critical of mainstream media. The Gateway Pundit is also known as a source of viral falsehoods and hoaxes. It's been described by the Harvard Journal of Law and Technology as one of the websites that primarily propagates fake news. The Washington Post reported that Turning Point Action, an affiliate of Turning Point USA, commissioned Rally Forge to churn out disinformation about COVID and election security. They happened to be using a troll farm that included teenagers as their employees. You may recall that Johnston, Iowa Community School District in this spring approved a chapter at the high school of Turning Point USA, just FYI. You get the idea. There are news media out there that are reliable, and there are news media out there that may not be. And then consider the many organizations that purvey rumors and lies. QAnon is a group that most of you have undoubtedly heard of that proliferates theories via social media, both mainstream and alternative. It's been reported that 15% of Americans agree with QAnon's statement that the United States government, media, and financial worlds are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles. The source of that data is the Public Religion Research Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to conducting independent research at the intersection of religion, culture, and public policy. I didn't make it up. An analysis found 78 QAnon-aligned candidates on 2022 state and federal ballots across the United States, according to Business Insider. Approximately 1 in 10 of the people arrested for January 6th had some kind of affiliation with QAnon. This group's use of social media stands as an exemplar of how to reach a wide audience with disinformation. A number of other groups, of course, use social media as well to disseminate rumors and conspiracy theories. The People for the American Way lists dozens. Well, since it's campaign season, let's talk about political ads and whether disinformation invades that environment. And indeed, I think we'll find that it can, maybe does. The First Amendment right to free speech is a foundation for political ads to be free from fact-checking or scrutiny. We prize free speech. Shannon alluded to this earlier. It is probably one of the rights that we hold most dear in this country for good reason. It is an important right that we have. And it's one that we want to protect in every way we can. While there is legislation that governs campaign financing and disclosure of sponsorship, content is another matter. For example, the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971 focuses on campaign finance, but there is nothing in that act about truthfulness. As of 2014, 27 states prohibited certain kinds of false statements, according to a tally by the National Conference of State Legislatures, which tracks state laws. However, since 2014, courts have struck down those laws in favor of free speech in 4 of those states, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Ohio, because, as I say, we prize dearly our free speech. Meanwhile, California, Maryland, New York, and Washington State crafted new transparency laws for digital political advertisements in the wake of Russian social media interference in 2016. But once again, courts have pushed back against these efforts. And in January, a federal judge ruled that the Maryland law that regulates political ads on social platforms violates the First Amendment. The Federal Election Commission, FEC, is tasked with requiring disclosure, they call them disclaimers, of who paid for and who authorized federal political advertising. This is required for all public communication. However, the internet is not expressly covered. And in fact, the FEC has held that general public political advertising largely does not encompass content on the internet. The FEC has no regulation of content in political advertising. Then there's the FTC. The FTC has rules on truth in advertising, but that's commercial advertising. It does not apply to political advertising. The FCC does not govern content. That is a free speech issue. The FCC does not review or pre-approve the content of political ads. It does not ensure the accuracy of statements that are made by candidates and issue advertisers, does not require broadcast stations and other regulatees to provide all sides of controversial issues. That was back in the days of the Fairness Doctrine, which died during the Reagan administration at the beginning of the rise of cable news. And then there's Congress, mostly silent. The Honest Ad Act, introduced by Klobuchar, Warner, and Graham in 2017, would have sought to include digital media in the Federal Election Commission Act of 1971, which would, again, only focus on sponsorship but not on content. And that bill was introduced but not passed into law anyway. So far, Congress remains silent as well. Meanwhile, in campaign work is an entire industry called oppositional research. This is an industry employed by political parties and campaigns to, I would say, dig up dirt on the opposition. The American Bridge states on their website that this is what they're trying to do. Quote, "We find what Republicans are hiding and make sure voters hear about it." Oppositional research is common practice in politics. It feeds outlets with often sensational, often negative information, sometimes true, sometimes misleading, sometimes downright false. It works on both sides of the political spectrum. And when you hear sources report, da-da-da-da-da, ask whether oppositional research might be the source. Are there any limits on free speech? Well, perhaps when it comes to threats of violence. In the 1960s, Brandenburg, a leader of the Ku Klux Klan, made a speech at a Klan rally that advocated for violence. This raised the question of whether there are any limits on free speech, and the case resulted in a three-part test of legal limitations related to imminent violence or unlawful actions. The three-part test that emerged from that decision: is there serious intent to incite violence? Is the threat of unlawful action imminent? How likely is the unlawful or violent act? Beyond such limitations, free speech remains highly prized and defended. So, the question of the day: what do we do about conspiracy theories, hoaxes, rumors, and lies? Let's look at a few categories of possible solutions. Personal, educational, technological, or legal or policy. Let's think what we can do. First of all, remember that, you know, there is that little rule that says the only behavior I have control of is my own. So first we'll look at personal things we can do. I loved a quote from Nick Johnson in the Press Citizen this week where he said, "We all have the responsibility to be our own governor." And I think he's right. It's up to us. So one of the things that I suggest that we can do is choose an aggregator to provide links to the day's news. And watch out that you don't get drawn down into a rabbit hole. An aggregator collects news from other sources and brings stories together for the reader's convenience. Aggregators show content based on the user's interest and content to which they subscribed. These websites either display articles on their platform or link to the primary article sources. And I've listed four here. Axios is a little bit center-left. The Bulwark is a little bit center-right. The flip side tries to cover it all and cover news from both the left and the right. And Smart News calls themselves fair and balanced, and again, they try to bring in news media from both sides of the spectrum. The bottom line is, it's pretty hard to find anything that doesn't have any bias, quite honestly, among aggregators. For basic good journalism, I would commend to you AP News or Reuters, and that's going to be largely just the facts. So those might be resources that you rely on for your news in order to be able to feel as if you're getting authoritative and reliable factual information. I add the Christian Science Monitor here because there's something I love about the Christian Science Monitor, and that is that when they publish a story, they tell you why they wrote it. And I think that's an interesting aspect of journalism and one worth applauding. The bottom line, though, to my way of thinking, is we need to support responsible journalism. Every one of us needs to subscribe to publications that seem authoritative and reliable, because if we don't pay for good journalism, we are not going to have good journalism going forward. In addition to choosing our sources, there are Coming forward, there's lots of development of tools underway, particularly in the world of artificial intelligence. The RAND Corporation lists several new browser extensions and tools to assist in analyzing reports online. For example, Trusted News is an artificial intelligence browser extension that helps you evaluate what you're about to read online, even before you've read it. Just like grocery nutrition labels, information nutrition labels tag online news articles with context that can help you know what to trust and what to watch out for. Right now, this browser extension only works on long-form articles. I tried it out with an article myself, and it highlights the text that it finds to be objective and scores the overall piece. There are many more tools like this in development, and we're going to see a burgeoning array of resources that will help us be smarter about the ways we read, particularly on the internet, going forward. So I think those are things to keep an eye out for. Obviously, those of you who have heard me speak before have heard me talk about the media bias chart. If you encounter a publication with which you're not familiar, you can go and look it up on the media bias chart and see where it stands left, right, in terms of political bent, and also where it stands in terms of authoritative or not so much so. So I continue to commend the media bias chart, which you can Google online. There are educational solutions. This is probably the solution I'm most excited about, because I think there's plenty we can do with students in our schools today to help them be better than we are at how we consume information out there. I think there are important dispositions we need to engender in kids growing up, dispositions of open-mindedness, of curiosity, being investigative, what more do I need to know? Kinds of questions, and metacognitive most of all, being aware of what they're doing, what they're looking at, where it's coming from, what the sources are for the information that they consume. There are specific skills also that students today need to learn. These are the skills that librarians are trying to teach students, how to do lateral reading, that is reading across the internet instead of just reading down, critical reading, and certainly the notion of recognizing evidence and understanding what is evidence and what is not evidence. I have a son who teaches in China. He teaches in an international baccalaureate school there. And in that school, there is a commitment to what they call the learner profile. This is a set of dispositions and attitudes and behaviors that they intend to develop in students from K through 12. They are intentional about teaching to these dispositions and behaviors, and they encourage students, require students, in fact, to reflect on their own performance through the lens of these dispositions. I would have to say that if we had students graduating from our schools carrying with them all of these dispositions, we wouldn't need to worry about disinformation. There are many resources for educators. Educators don't have to invent the wheel to figure out how to teach these important skills. I list here four resources that are particularly fine: Checkology from the News Literacy Project, schooljournalism.org, Civic Online Reasoning from Stanford University, and MediaWise from the Poynter Institute. But there are others as well, but these four are really outstanding. There are, of course, technology solutions as well. Tech companies are developing software programs that can detect patterns, they can deter falsehoods from spreading so rapidly by assigning them lower rankings, by flagging them, by removing them if they must, but probably more likely ranking and flagging. Slate.com offers a tool that will identify, debunk, and combat proliferation of bogus stories. They can require real name registration so that users have to provide the hosting platform with their true identity in an effort to combat internet bots. Computer programs that can imitate a person and proliferate information. As I mentioned before, there's currently much development going on in apps and browser extensions that will help us be smarter at how we use the internet for information going forward. I think there are important solutions from journalism to avoid repeating falsehoods, to avoid sensationalizing the news. to verify information before breaking the news. There are many examples where breaking news turned out to not be quite right. But in the quest to be first to get the news out, there's not always the quest to be right. And to participate, basically to practice professional journalism and call out those who don't. Legal and policy solutions are harder. Do we want to limit free speech? Probably not. There is a sentiment that says the best solution to false speech is more speech. And this is clearly a place where the slippery slope argument applies. The FEC, is there anything that the FEC wants to do in relationship to truthfulness in political campaigns? Again, observing the concerns for free speech will make that difficult. The FTC, does it want to apply truth in advertising to truth in political advertising? That is a difficult question again. And again, the issue of free speech looms large there. The FCC, is there a fairness doctrine 2.0? Hard to say. It's difficult. It's a much more difficult environment now than it was back in the day when we had a fairness doctrine where the requirement was that news outlets needed to cover controversial topics, but they needed to cover them from both sides of the political spectrum. They needed to offer a fair and balanced presentation of those controversies. That's much more difficult to govern today than it was when we had ABC, NBC, CBS. Congress? Not sure what there is that Congress can do. I think that's a difficult question and one for you to ponder as well with me. Again, maintaining respect for that notion of free speech is important to our way of governing. Bottom line, information is power. Disinformation is abuse of power. What will we do to counter its dissemination and its effect on society, government, and individual? I think it begins with what we do personally. We have a few minutes for time. We have a few minutes for comments or questions. I'd certainly welcome insights that you all have. Mary. The question is whether or not I've examined the grading scheme that the Cedar Rapids Gazette employs sometimes in looking at political ads and other content as well. And I have to say I haven't done a close analysis of those, so I really can't speak to that. But I admire their effort to try to help us be in that thinking mode of saying, you know, how much of this seems to be, or how much of this is accurate, how much of it is verifiable. And I think if they can at least make us think that way, whether or not, you know, we agree with the way they're doing it, I think it's important for all of us to be thinking that way. Mm-hmm. Yes. Why do I think QAnon is more successful than some other organizations and platforms? You know, I don't know that I have a definitive answer for that, but I can speculate a little bit. Maybe some of the rest of you can help me speculate that as well. But I would say they have a really good organization, and they have a really good marketing strategy, and they have been very effective at using social media to proliferate their messages, and have done so in a very convincing way. So I think they've they've kind of, I'm not exactly sure how to say this. They Well, I guess I'll stop there. That's what I would say. Yeah. Jen.
So one of the phrases you mentioned about conspiracy theory was immune to evidence. Is there evidence or studies that show something that is more effective on taking, you know, obviously helping out people who have been aided by conspiracies and getting away from them?
Okay, the question is that I indicated that oftentimes people who are drawn in by disinformation are immune to evidence, and is there another way in which we can approach them if providing evidence isn't effective? I think that's a really good question. One of the things I think about all the time when I think about people who are drawn in is that oftentimes it is not a rational decision. It's an emotional draw. And it's feeding emotional needs of fear or uncertainty, those kinds of, you know, emotions. And so we need to be cognizant of that and sensitive to that. And perhaps thinking, having that in mind can help us think about how we try to allay that fear or allay that worry before we try to take on any kind of a cognitive argument. Rod.
Can you talk a little bit about, for lack of a better term, both scientism and the idea of the media being unwilling to just say what's right and wrong?
No. I guess I don't really have a good answer to that. The thing we have to keep in mind about news today and how it's different from news back in the day is that when we used to have a half hour of news at the end of the day, it was not the moneymaker for that network. In fact, it was probably a loser. and they made their money on soap operas and sitcoms. Now we have channels that make their money on their presentation of the news, and because that's all they do. And when you are driven by advertising revenue and being able to, you know, stay alive by making money on your programming, I think that's where the whole business of trying to appeal to certain audiences, trying to draw in the biggest audience that you can, becomes the compelling motivator. And I think that plays into the question that you raise. Yes. Well, the curricula that I mentioned here that all are really focused on information literacy all have components of critical thinking. So there are lessons and units within those curricula that really look at how to be a critical thinker. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate being here.